Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird. Praise for the singing, praise for the morning, praise for them springing fresh from. The rain's new fall, sunlit from heaven, like the first dew fall on the first grass. Praise for the sweetness of the wet garden, sprung in completeness where his feet. Mine is the sunlight, mine is the morning, born of the one light, Eden saw play. Praise with elation, praise every morning, God's recreation of the new day. Morning has broken.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. This is our new time slot for the Artist Experience radio program. And we hope you can join us with your morning joe, your OJ, or maybe your English breakfast tea, or even a smoothie. But we have our own smoothie right here in the studio in Bobby Hill. And we want to be the cream cheese schmear on your bagel, possibly the jelly on your English muffin, or the butter on your toast, or maybe those blueberries in your scone, or we want to be the chocolate on your croissant. So we hope we can get you juiced with talking about art this morning. You are tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. It's 94.3 on your FM station. This is your community radio station, and we hope you're enjoying us on the airways. We hope we've enjoyed Meg and her eclectic mix of tunes that start this morning. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we're the hosts of the Art is Experience radio show. We hope you enjoyed our previous programming.
Hi, this is Sheila. Art is Experience is an hour radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help the viewer, when they visit the exhibit, create in their soul, in their own experience, their own work of art. We also have an Artist Experience Facebook page where we put images of the things we're talking about. It's also a place where we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. You can also stream the program on tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, so that you can really listen at any time.
Well, today we have a great show, and our enthusiasm is so hot about it, we could warm up your coffee over the airways. We want to introduce our listeners to the new and improved Krieger Museum in Washington, D.C., Northwest. This was the home of David Lloyd Krieger and his wife, Carmen. This building was built by the late famous architect Philip Johnson and Richard Foster in 1963. Art exudes in this place, and the Kriegers were pillars of the D.C. art community. Sheila, share a bit about the Kriegers and their collection tastes.
Sure. Well, one of the greatest legacies of David and Carmen Krieger is their museum. They've left a lot of buildings. They have the Krieger Museum, Krieger Music Building at AU. They have the Krieger Theater at the Arena Stage. But this museum is really special. It really reflects their spirit. There's a small admission price, but it's really well worth it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So David Krieger was the son of Russian immigrants, and he worked his way through college and Harvard Law by playing piano in summer resorts. He was an also accomplished violinist, and he became CEO of Geico Insurance. He was the president of the National Symphony Orchestra, president of the Corcoran Gallery of Art, and together with his wife, Carmen, they gave both time and money to developing artistic talent. They had competitions, they had different donations to different schools, and you know, when I hear a resume like this, I kind of, it depersonalizes the people. It's like, who are these very wealthy people who could do all this? But let's not do that. It's like we think rich people living at the top, but that's how museums come into being. And think about it. The Mellons, Joseph Hirshhorn, the Rails, the Phillips, Ian Woodner.
Yeah, thank God, thank goodness they give it to a place.
You just can't do any better than that. Yeah. So this museum is really a gift to all of us.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, it is. And I mean, it's one of those places where you just kind of just surrender to the art.
Yes, you do. When we walked in, oh my God. Unfortunately, Carmen Krieger, I think it's a generational thing because she was really his partner in all of this, in the art collecting. They agreed on everything, or they never bought anything they didn't agree on. And, but it's really hard to find anything written about her. So I just assume she was a perfect wife and mother and did everything beautifully.
Good for her.
Yeah. They also did a lot of entertaining and in their home, which is the museum now. So I wanted to start with the building. As Tom said, it's designed by Philip Johnson and Richard Foster. And it has, Philip Johnson was the first architect to claim sort of the world architecture as his play area. Mm-hmm. He did, it's hard to say really play area, but it's his arena. And so there's sort of echoes of Middle Eastern art in here. There's lots of archways, repetitive archways, and lots of light. And so the building itself has sort of a symphonic cadence and enhances the collection, but it doesn't overpower it. And unlike the Phillips, where it was a home and you get that when you walk, even with all the additions, you still get that the Phillips collection was
home. Absolutely.
This one is hard to imagine. So I assume there was a TV rec room in the basement in the lower level.
Yeah, I didn't get that. I didn't see any bathrooms either, but I'm sure they're there.
That's true. So the Kriegers both were amateur museums, and they hosted a lot of concerts there. And so this connection with music is both in the building and in the collection.
Yeah, with Clay and Kandinsky. These are people that love music. Well, this is a really amazing place to see art as experience. And, of course, this is the title of our program and the mission of our show. It's about the pleasure of seeing art in a beautiful space. And I think that's where the Krieger shines. Our initial reaction was one of seeing art in comfort. Now, I really don't think about that when I go to the National Gallery, which is a great museum, but not in comfort. And the lights in the gallery, the color of the walls, the space between the art, it just seemed just right, Sheila. I mean, it was like, it was so important to be comfortable, to allow your experience to aesthetically expand the senses, and to, you know, to allow that response to the work with ease. There was, you know, there was no tension of other people kind of getting, what about that pleasure in seeing the work?
Oh, my God. You just, it's something, I have to say that at the outset that I broke my knee a couple of weeks ago, so I'm all about comfort right now. And when we walked into the museum, it was just like you just let out this sigh, like, ah, this is beauty. That's why we're here. And the museum is a little bit out of the way. It's on Foxhall Road. The only thing that is that it's just not on the mall. But it's well worth getting to. It's not hard. And it's been closed for renovation for 3 years, and they just opened half of the museum. So the very second we walked in, well, I sort of hobbled in. The people who greeted us were really welcoming. And right at the front wall was a painting by Larry Poons. He was a color painter in the 60s. And, you know, there's a whole Washington Color School. And he was completely immersed in the interactions of color, and he used it in a beautiful way. He made sort of these sort of lozenge shapes that it was on a ground, and the shapes kind of worked their way, I don't know, back and forth. They had a lot of rhythm to them.
Yeah, it was
a lot
musical
of music.
As well. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
music. And Seems Larry Poons, he was a musician before he was a painter. But the only trouble with that painting, and it's wonderful, is that it's behind a table in the entrance hall. And so you really don't think of it as art. It looks more like background.
Or like decoration.
Decoration kind of does. But anyway, it's... So the unifying elements of these of this collection are color and texture. And there's a predominance of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist paintings, and often the little gem of a great painter. That's what you really see here. Like there's a Pissarro in the Tuileries Gardens, and then there are Cubists, Braque, and Picasso that lead you up into the mid-20th century. So a lot of these works have music in them.
Yeah, so you walk into the first main gallery, which is Impressionist art, and it's a very impressive impression, pun intended.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, and we have Pissarro and Alfred Sisley and all those Claude Monets. It's a wonderful entree, and they're very well-done works. I mean, it's not the masterpieces that you might know by Monet or Sisley, but they're very strong paintings, and they typify Impressionism. And, you know, why do I call them strong paintings? Is because Impressionism, firstly, was a movement that name wasn't given by the artists themselves, and it was devised by critics and so on and so forth in Paris in the 1870s, like Monet, Renoir, Sisley, and Pissarro, and there are others, Impressionists, but these artists were concerned with light, color, and brush movement, and somewhat space in an engaging, adventurous compositions. And I think you walk in, and these are really pure paintings. And that's what you kind of walk into the space, and it's pure painting. It's a large room. It's very welcoming. The light is wonderful on these paintings, and we got a chance to see all these Impressionist paintings was really, you know, stress-free, like we said before. And then all of a sudden, I turn around, and there's a Pierre Bonnard. And I said, oh, my co-host, Sheila Blake, she's going to get a little excited at this moment. So, Sheila, why don't we talk about Sailboat on the Sea by Pierre Bonnard, one of your favorites?
Well, he is. What can I say? Every week I say this in a different way. So there are two Bonnards, and they're just luminescent. They're fairly small, and the first one is a seascape of the bay. And really, the blues alone in that painting could make you either drown it or drink it.
Bravo,
it's really
yeah.
beautiful. And the sky is subtle, and it's full of color, full of blues and violets and pinks and grays. And the opposite shore of the bay is just perfectly dissolved into the atmosphere, and the foreground is this kind of ochre green with bright trees. It's so perfect how Bonnard doesn't use perspective. He just uses color and shape to place everything in space. The only thing, though, both Tom and I agree, there's this sort of gloppy sailboat out in the bay. I don't know. I'm sure it's something he was seeing, but I mean, I'm not going to criticize the master, but this kind of thick
Better not.
Is sort of distracting. And the other Bonnard is very nice, but much lower keyed. It's a different weather, different day. It's colder. And, you know, Tom, once you said, not every painting is a home run. Well, they are lovely. And the thing is about them that every Bonnard composition is a little gift in a big gift, really, in a small package. They are really something. And so there is a masterpiece in this collection, but I'll get to it later. Okay.
And then we have Max Beckmann, which is an artist that I always responded to with his heavy lines and heaviness. What do you think about that Sunny Beach with Painters?
I know. It's so funny. It's a great title for Sunny Beach with Painters, because Max Beckmann was a master of black paint. So you come from those Bonnards, which are really are just like a sunny day in the summer. And then you come to the Beckmann, which is the same subject. It's like the beach, but it's all like,
Yeah, awkward, and you know, people, they don't look that comfortable on their blanket.
No, they have these people lying out of the
powerful blanket. Nonetheless.
It is, and this painting was done at the same year that Beckmann escaped from Germany to Amsterdam, and so it's probably maybe once he got to Amsterdam or a memory of Germany, because it's hard to say that this beach scene, it has so much, I don't know, an ominous quality to it.
Yeah, there's angst in
there's
it.
There's angst
yeah, there
in
really
it.
Is, yeah.
And it's
yeah.
all about structure. And then there's this other picture called Children at Play. It's these are not really children. They're kind of terrible little monsters. And they're playing in some kind of thing that may be an airplane made out of logs. And one of them is holding a pitchfork. And one has a crow instead of a head. So, and this is sort of a contrast, this bright blue sunny sky.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So in the same vein as in Edward Munch. Munch is famous for that painting, The Scream. There are actually three paintings of The Scream. And his over-the-top existential depiction of the human condition, which people loved those paintings because they were in tote bags and they were in blow-up dolls.
They've been used forever.
Yeah, a big seller. And he did a lot of other paintings too. And this one here, it's almost like he's taking a break from a holiday from the anxiety of the universe to paint a nice small plein air portrait of a man with a hat on a veranda, and it's looking past to the sea. It's small, it's nice, and as far as I can tell, it's Munch trying out being French.
Ah, that's a very good thing to say. And the ochres and the whites and the blacks in there kind of were reminiscent of Manet, but yeah, it's a Munch probably without the anxiety.
It's true.
It was kind of like, you know, stress-free Munch, which is hard to come by. in the same wonderful room as you enter the museum, there's this incredible pastel. And Sheila, you're a pastel painter. Mm-hmm. And it's just a gem. And the effects of snow on Argenteuil. And I thought that work was so impressive and so tiny. What'd you think about it? Knock me out.
Oh, it's beautiful. You know, I was thinking about this, that I don't really make much of a distinction between mediums as long as they're color when I'm working. But I love to work in pastels, and in my studio I have tables full of pastels. I need every damn color, and they help me think.
You have every color.
I do have every color. It's like mountains of pastels. But the thing is that when I've got oil paints on my palette, maybe I have 30 colors, but with pastels, and then none of those colors is going to be exactly the color I want. But in pastels, there's such a close variation of colors. So they really help me. They've helped me to think, because I could say, there's that perfect blue or that perfect pink. And so when I look at this pastel of the snow, it's like, look at those blues. There are warmer blues like cerulean and cobalt, and how they work together, and then the deep, almost purpley ultramarine blues for the shadows in the distance. And he uses the lightest of yellows and oranges for that bright snow, with small glints of the palest turquoise for the shadows over that bright snow surface. And then that same combination of colors is echoed in the sky. It's got the shadow from the snow closest to the viewer is the brightest of the blues, and a paler form of cerulean and cobalt, and they're echoed in the right-hand sky. So the left-hand sky is lit with subtle greens and pinks and violets, and echoed in the snow on the lower right. There's kind of a crisscross, and it really is like a beautiful lesson in Impressionism.
Absolutely right, and I think that's the thing about this little pastel painting. It's a real keeper for Impressionism.
Yes.
And it's also a nice a play next to those Monets. And, you know, let's get going on Monet, Sheila, because, you know, Monet is out there all the time.
All the time. Well, I know. You're tired of Monet. He's for beginners.
Oh, very good.
The first paintings that dazzle you. But here in this collection is a real Monet. I think this is like, it's called The Arm of the Seine at Giverny in the Fog. And just look at it. It's so subtle. The tree on the left with its reflection in the water and the distance with the fog coming off the water and fuzzing out the haze where the water meets the shore in the distance and the symmetry of the reflections of the trees, only the slightly brighter to distinguish the trees from their reflection. This painting is everything Monet knew about light, about the way that light allows for reflection and transparency so you can look into the water and at the water at the same time. It's something he accomplished 30 years later with pure genius in his water lilies. This is earlier, but I think these were, he had many life's great accomplishments, but along the way he had many masterpieces. And this one, which he painted in 1897, almost 30 years before he finished the water lilies, is the culmination of everything that came before it. We're so lucky to have this painting in Washington. There are more Monets, lots of Monets collection, but I believe this is the one.
Well, there's, you know, I think it was really important in the gallery. There's a small painting by Eugene Boudin, and he lived from 1824 to 1898, and this is a really good painting in the room because he's actually a pre-impressionist, and I think it shows you the difference between the ones that came before Monet, and sometimes he's associated with them, but he's not, and it's related to the Dutch painter Jean Can, who again was impetus to go out in the fields and paint and paint and paint like Monet, and it was so nice to see that plein air, you know, painting, which for our listeners means going outside to paint in French. And speaking of French, the Krieger is unique in giving these paintings their original French titles. You don't see that often in a lot of museums. You know, usually it's just a translation. And so I found these titles of the originals really sexy. I mean, in the Krieger, it really was. I mean, I had 6 years of French, and it was a great refresher course in the galleries. And I think it's amazing how I learned so much about preparing for this show when I got to the museum, realizing that there were bilingual titles, which I hats off to the Krieger. And I would have to say, you know, très bien for the Krieger Museum for doing this. And it was a great linguistical journey as well. Well, you know, WOWDLP is 15 months old, and the Artist Experience radio program has been here since the beginning. We've had an incredible fun, right, Sheila?
Every time.
And, you know, we're committed to taking you to local art venues and experiencing great art. And you've been with us along the way on this journey. And you're an important part of this program and our growth on the station. As you have grown to enjoy a diverse programming as your local community radio station, we ask you now to help us grow by making a financial contribution and support our unique and inventive programming that we've had at WOWDLP Tacoma Park and will continue to have. There is no other program like the Artist Experience Radio Show in all of the metro area. So take a moment between those sips of coffee and your nibbles on that scone and go online and press the donate button on our website at tacomaradio.org. Your support will help us provide you, our listener, with the listening pleasure you deserve. And we're here 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without commercial interruption. We thank you and we invite you to tell your friends and how good it feels to listen to WWDLP and to be an important supporter of local radio in your own community. So, you know, we really thank you for your support. You know, there's these two paintings of Van Gogh in flowers in this other room off, which, Sheila, I didn't even realize they didn't even look like a Van Gogh.
I know.
It was just amazing. It was something different for me to see. It was like an early Van Gogh.
Be early Van Goghs, and they've got sort of like his brushstrokes, but not really developed to the point of, I don't know, I want to say bossiness that he became.
Like an in-your-face brushstroke. Yeah. Well, they're kind of controlled and steady, but the environments are a bit wilder, like a portent to what his other paintings were. But these are two and very interesting Van Goghs in a room with a very old Picasso painting, which almost looks impressionistic, the Café at La Rotonde. And there's a wonderful Degas of a a woman doing her hair in this small room. But there's also those five Rodin small sculptures. And it's so nice to study a Rodin so close and so small in scale in this intimate space. Two of the works are standing saints, and there's also an athlete. It's great to see the hands in the work in a clay sculpture like that. And so we really encourage you to go into that little room and see Rodin's process. Well, we ask you not to change the dial or turn off your computers if you're streaming us live. And so we're going to ask our dear friend and Bobby, who's coming up shortly with this music. So make sure you stay tuned to listen to Bobby. He's Mr. Smooth in our studio right now. And his gift of sharing music to community is a wonder to Sheila and I. Stay tuned to Bobby and his beats and put some rhythm in your morning step.
WDLP. Support for Tacoma Radio comes from the Tacoma Langley Crossroads, home of Tiffin, the Indian Kitchen, serving traditional Southern Indian cuisine cooked in clay ovens since 1998. Located at 1341 University Boulevard. More information and menu at tiffinrestaurant.com. T-I-F-F-I-N restaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD LP Tacoma Park 94.3 FM. So we at Tacoma Radio want to provide the highest quality sound and reception to you, our listeners. But since Labor Day, some of our listeners and we at WOWD LP Tacoma Park have been hearing some other things on our frequency call number 94.3 FM. If you've been experiencing that your signal might have been invaded by something called WCTN Tried and True Top 40. We are not them. We want to hear about it from you because this is not us. And we need to get this taken care of with the FCC. So write us and tell us what you're experiencing on your end of the radio. Send an email to trex@tacomaradio.org to support our case and keep WOWD powerfully clear to all our supportive listeners out there like you. So we're coming back to the Krieger now. We're going to talk about the Brox. I can't find any evidence so far that Brock was a musician. He may have been, but there are a lot of instruments in his paintings.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Lutes, guitars, violins. And Brock and Picasso were the originators of Cubism. Brock said that it helped him to examine the facts of what he was painting by sort of dividing and splitting his images into facets so he can look at them. This is what he wanted, to take them apart. And what he did was he took his images apart and then he reconstructed them with a lot of freedom. So you can look everywhere in his compositions. You can look up at the ceiling, out of the window, at the floor. And he breaks up those images and the composition holds together in a completely different way. It cuts through things. And he gets like a shape from a lute or purple from the grapes, and that your eye never stops moving around. He often puts sand in his paint for texture. And this comes directly after Cézanne, who was looking at the facets of reality. And it's what led us into 20th century abstraction. The American painter John Marin and George Brock, they were brothers across the sea. It's really cool. And Picasso and Brock's work, they began as artists together, developing Cubism, and then they split apart. The Picassos are good if you like Picasso, but I'm never going to love Picasso. They don't hold a candle to the Brocks.
Be nice, Sheila. Well, you know, I agree with you, actually.
Oh, really?
Well,
how cool.
Well, the natural light in this small room is absolutely lovely, and we were in there in the morning, and not all the paintings in the room are showstoppers, I have to admit. But there's something about the room that I do appreciate, and I thank the Krieger for this. There's a wonderful embellishments of the room to African and Asian art, mm-hmm. and that's what the Cubists were looking at. I mean, there's an African mask. I think mm-hmm. it's from Niger. It's just so perfect because that's the impetus to a lot of what Picasso was looking at. And, you know, because African art kind of breaks the planes like they do in Cubism to simplify them in an abstracting mm-hmm. way. The African and the Asian art, they work to divide the spaces. So it gives you like a breath between the large paintings. And that breath mm-hmm. is actually really important because you have to look a lot at these abstract Cubist paintings. And there's a lot of pieces in there. And the other thing is these are anonymous artists. I mean, the African and Asian arts. And they just do an unbelievable job at the fauna and the flora in making these mask-like sculptures. And, you know, it's interesting. I remember years ago we used to call these the primitives, right?
Yeah,
the African
right.
art
right.
was the primitive. Well, you know, let's face it. There was so much visual sophistication, and it was so much for the impetus to Picasso and Gorky, as you see Gorky in the room as well. And so these artists were gobbling up these powerful images of African art, and they were brought to the continent during colonialism, and these European artists took off with that. And among them is this Miró painting. And Juan Miró is sometimes put into the surrealist category. He's kind of on the fence in some ways. But this Miró is really important. When I see a Miró, I think of a magician with paint.
Wow.
That's just how I see Miró. I mean, he was this kind of really like little guy that was so powerful with the paint. And he also paints a world in a different visual language, much mm-hmm. like the African masks, and almost the sophistication of a wise child.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see Miró. And when I saw the Krieger Miró, I think it was just artist experience in a daydream. It was a really beautiful painting. What about that magic, Sheila?
Yeah.
Huh?
Were you
with me on that?
Well, I'm going to tell the truth about this. But first of all, I want to say the visual language I think that is such an important concept. And I think that the greatest painters, what they did was they developed their own visual language. And his visual language has always been kind of opaque to me. So I'm going to admit that years ago, we went to the Miró Foundation in Barcelona, and it's a beautiful place. It's up on a hillside, and it's very peaceful. And I'm sure it's like the best place ever to absorb his work. But I was confused and I was embarrassed because I didn't know where to begin. And I think if you had told me that concept of visual language then and there, I think it would have been really helpful to me. Because it wasn't until years later when there was a Calder Miró show at the Phillips, and by some miracle, my mind just opened. And I saw these paintings and I saw how they worked in space and how the Calders and the Mirós are very like they're talking to each other all the time. And Miró also was a sculptor, but in this case, the paintings are like on a canvas what Calder did. And so it just helped me open my mind, because I hate to reject something because I don't understand it.
That's a wonderful thing as a student of art to kind of get through that.
Yeah.
You know, thanks for that confession. I think it's really, really important for our listeners out there that, you know, make art. I think that's really, really important to kind of be studious about the looking and the learning in looking at art. I think it's really important.
It happens to me all the time.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. We're still learning.
Yeah.
Even doing this radio show.
Sure. So Alexander Calder is like a living, breathing Miró because, in his work, it moves. But there's movement in these Mirós also. And they knew each other in Paris, and they both got their inspiration from nature and from the surrealist notion that the most authentic inspiration comes from the unconscious. But Miró's work can turn on itself. It has a brooding quality that Calder's almost never does.
Yeah.
And they really sometimes reflect the dark side of the human condition. So this strange collage has all of that. This, I'm going to be completely honest here. What I see when I'm trying to decipher this unconscious imagery is that it seems to be a chicken with his guard up. He's got everything coming out, and he's completely on alert, and there's a foreboding creature that it's approaching from the darkness and signaling. So this chicken creature has a red sun for his eye, and many Miró paintings, they have a red sun. And it's really like, I'm so glad that you relate to it so easily, because it really is difficult for me to relate to it in any kind of real intuitive way.
Well, I think that's a wonderful thing as well. I Calder and Miró are absolutely soulmates in the visual communication. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And I think sometimes, like we had that show, remember many months ago, but sometimes you just don't get it.
Yeah,
and
right.
You know, we don't always have to get every painting. And I think Calder's a little more understandable and in a kind of an American, you know, simplistic way, quite easily more communicative. But Miró's out there. There is just no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. Well, what about this understanding of this contemporary world by Miró? Share with us some of these things.
Okay. Well, there's a guy, Terry Barrett, and he was an art critic, and he wrote a book called Criticizing Art, Understanding the Contemporary. And he has principles of interpretation. So listen to a few of these.
Yeah, go ahead. Right ahead.
Sure. First, artworks have aboutness, and they demand interpretation.
Yeah.
And some interpretations are persuasive arguments. Some interpretations are better than others. Good interpretations of art tell about the critic.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Isn't that an interesting one? Yeah. And feelings are guides to interpretations, which is great, because your feelings come first, or they come along with the interpretation. And there can be different competing and contradictory interpretations of the same work.
I think that's reminiscent of our humanity Everybody comes into the work with a different, you know, thing to say or a different opinion, because everybody has a different, you know, kind of aesthetic value about their own experience, what their lives have given them. So they look at a painting and they interpret it through their experience. I think that's the key, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to leave this list for a while because it's really instructive, but I think a little at a time is a good idea. And I'm going to tell you that this is WOWD, Tacoma Parks Community Radio Station, and I'm pitching for the station. We need your money.
Absolutely, we do, yes.
This is the most creative enterprise I've ever been a part of, and almost everyone here at the station is working for free.
Yeah, volunteering.
Volunteering. Why? Because this community has so much amazing talent. It really does. You see people on the street and they kind of look like they're ordinary coming back from the farmer's market or the co-op. And you don't know what they have to share. It's amazing. So in this station, there's music from all over the world and music from around the corner. One of my favorite shows is Ride with Clyde. He's a DJ, and while he drives people around Washington, he asks them about their favorite music, and then he plays it. So you never know what you're going to get. And, of course, my favorite is our talk show.
Yeah, better believe it.
I have a friend who's an artist, and when we used to come home from a dinner party, we'd say, not one person asked us about art or what we do. And I'd say, well, they don't know what to ask. So I got this show, and between Tom and me, we ask the questions and we answer them. It's information about art by artists with a cherry on top.
Absolutely.
So talk shows like this one with young people and older people and everyone in between, it's such an exciting thing, this station, but we're practically running on fumes. So join us. Be part of us. No donation is too small. And you go to tacomapark.org and click on the donation button. It's and be part of this experiment.
Yeah, thank you for that, Sheila. And getting back to the Krieger, that, you know, I have a place in my heart for the wonderful artist Ashil Gorky. Ashil Gorky was an Armenian artist that came to America after personally seeing the horrors of war and genocide perpetrated literally to his own family and his own people. And his short life was filled with a lot of emotional and psychological tribulations. But there are two wonderful, wonderful paintings in the gallery by this very much fantastic painter. And they're very neutral compared to the other paintings in the gallery, like the Brox and the Miro. But it's an amazing collection of movement and spontaneity in these works. And even though they're a little more subdued than most of other Gorkys that are around, but it's a great, great balance of color and movement, and it's a terrific addition to this room. Sheila, what about this Washington Color School? I'm really kind of foggy about
this
those guys.
This is WOWD 94.3 Tacoma Park Radio Station.
Support. Well, in the 1960s, Washington did have its own art movement. It was called the Washington Color School, and it included Morris Lewis, Kenneth Nolan, Thomas Dowling, Gene Davis. Gene Davis, who was known for his stripe paintings, is represented in this collection by an earlier stained canvas. And in doing a little research, it looked like Clement Greenberg, who we've talked about before, he was an art critic. He was also the boyfriend of Helen Frankenthaler. He took some of these artists, these color school artists from Washington, to Frankenthaler's studio when she wasn't there to show him what she was working on. And she was started working on unprimed canvas, staining it with color. Right. And it was kind of like saying the paint and the canvas are all the same thing. And her famous, most famous canvas, Mountains and Sea, is at the National Gallery. And what it looks like is that Gene Davis saw these paintings and he absorbed something about them. And they have a beautiful painting of his, which is nothing like his stripe paintings in this collection. But maybe he backed off into stripes when Helen Frankenthaler made her big breakthrough. Hard to say, because his work became very hard-edged and her work became very free. And I don't really know whose work came first. It's a guess. And but it's very, very nice painting. In the stairwell, there's a Thomas Downing, who has always stayed in Washington. A lot of those artists went on to New York, but he stayed here and continued with his experiments with color. He never got to be Frank Stella or Kenneth Noland, but it's a handsome painting.
Yeah, it's an interesting painting. I haven't really kind of been able to kind of digest a lot of the Washington Color School artists. But in that same hallway kind of where you begin to go up to the second floor, which is still being renovated, there's a wonderful group of surrealist works and that are very intimate. There's a Paul Delvaux painting called The Secret, and it's rooted in pure surrealism in that it's very dreamlike. And it's a nude and multiple of the same nude in an architectural landscape, which is very reminiscent of my favorite surrealist, the Italian Giorgio de Chirico. And then there's an Yves Tanguy, who's so much like Salvador Dali. Sometimes they're hard to even differentiate. And that's another wonderful painting. But there's a really stellar painting by Man Ray, The Red Knight, which is, when Man Ray was working kind of in a surrealist mode. It's a super little Carter with gems like a Henry Moore sculpture. And then there's this other hallway, which has Vasily Kandinsky on that corner, which is a very poetic and musical painting as well. And then that when you go down that small corridor, there's these intimate Paul Klees and Kandinskys. And these are a little hard to see in the dark space. But my only thought is that they are works on paper, so they can't take much light. But that's a wonderful little hallway to kind of study these small and intimate works. And Paul Klee, again, he was a concert violinist. He was quite proficient in that. Mm-hmm. And, what about Kandinsky here?
Well, Kandinsky really thought of painting and composing music as part of the same thing. And he did paintings, his sort of middle time paintings are like, they're just like symphonies. He said, color is the keyboard, the eyes are the hammers, the soul is the piano with many strings. The artist is the hand which plays, touching one key or another to cause vibrations in the soul. So these paintings are very easy for me. They have shapes and forms and direction, and they have expressive color. So it's like landscapes in the air. They're moving, and they just open your mind. But the late ones, he created a visual language that corresponded to the 12-tone scale of Schoenberg. And I just can't get past it. I've seen so many of these paintings, and they are so clearly, methodical and about things. But it's very hard for me. It's very hard for me to really understand them. But I keep on looking. And I want to say that since I hurt my knee, I can't move around my studio much. And so I've used the inspiration from the Krieger to do some of these really light-filled watercolors. It's amazing how experiencing these works have cast their light into my work.
Well, you know, that kind of thing with the Kandinskys, I think he's so sophisticated.
He's too that sophisticated
he's
for me.
Way
exactly.
Out there. He's on another realm. In
yes,
fact, I think
is.
He's even further on the realm than Miro there. So I don't know, you really have to kind of take a lot of time to digest those. Well, you know, I think it's important to mention here that the Krieger Museum is really on beautiful grounds. I think it's about 5 acres, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And the sculpture garden is quite lovely. It's somewhat terraced in some ways, and they have wonderful works. And they're spaced nicely, and you can see them from inside, which is quite nice. And they're really a collection of great artists and fine works by these artists like Henry Moore, Jacques Lipschitz was one of my favorite sculptors, actually. And playful sculptures by Hans Arp. And another favorite of mine is Aristide Malliol, who was really these kind of voluptuous female nudes, and they're really superb, and the scale of them is quite nice too. They're kind of larger than life, and there's even a Noguchi on the grounds. There are other artists that are somewhat interesting, and they're more modern sculptures, like the linear works of George Ricci, who's I think also represented in the east wing of the National Gallery, and Dalia Lutok, which is Lutwak, is an interesting tree kind of in nature. It's called Poison Ivy, and there's others by Leonardo Nierman. Well, the Kriegers are really a great place to go on a beautiful day and meditate on the works. And I think that's why, because there's a forest back there. It's really kind of nestled. And I think that's the important thing about that. When I use the word meditate, I'm using it quite seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, to go there and just take time to think about your life and think about these works and how you kind of exchange and dialogue with them. So the sculpture garden also kind of, for me, especially with the forest behind it, kind of talks about the immortality of art. You know, art never dies. It's always the continuity of humanity since the very beginning. And I think seeing these some of these works in the direct sun or in shade, it kind of thinks about the kind of the evolution of humanity. And it's very, very important to me. Well, the Krieger Museum is open to the public again, and the top floor is still being renovated, but it's really a beautiful place. And visit their website, thekriegermuseum.org, to tantalize yourself in seeing what an amazing array of music from the periods for artists over the globe. The museum has a suggested donation, but it's really worth it. And the Krieger Museum's a keeper. There's nothing more wonderful to share with our listeners about these hidden gems in Washington. I mean, we're very enthusiastic about this, as you can hear in our voices. And the intimacy and the size of the museum makes it for a rare and unique opportunity to study terrific works of art. The atmosphere is conducive to looking at these works with a fresh eye, and I think that's really important. You come to these works in a real fresh eye. And without the pressure of large crowds, it's off the beaten track, as Sheila mentioned, but you know what? On a beautiful autumn day or winter day, it's worth it. We hope you've enjoyed the show.
Back for a minute. Here are some upcoming programs that we're excited about. We need to revisit drawing, as we've never done an entire show on drawing. At the National Gallery of Art on the Mall in early October, there'll be an exhibition of Dutch drawing, Bosch to Bloemaert, early Netherlandish drawing from museum in Rotterdam. So starting on October 8th, I will learn about that, but Bosch and Rembrandt and others will be worth seeing, as I am teaching drawing this semester.
Well, Sheila, I'm wondering if our listeners would love to see an exhibition on pets. This is true, an art exhibition. I think it would be really fun to do a show on the divine felines, the cats of ancient Egypt. It's at the Freer Galleries on the Mall, and it's free and open, and it opens in mid-October. And just not to insult those cat lovers, they also have some artwork about dogs. So, you know, well, we want your kitties and pooches to be well represented on the Mall there. Sheila and I would like to thank our engineer, Bobby Hill. We couldn't do without you, Bobby. Thanks so much. Stay tuned to our next exciting programming on WOWDLP Tacoma Park. And we have Bobby Hill coming up right after us with this music up to the 1 o'clock hour and with avant-garde jazz. And also stay tuned and keep Bobby fixed to your dial. Other programs this afternoon are we have Roots Rock and Reggae, and this program is going to make your afternoon not miss a beat with Soul Rebel and Sam Jam. Saturdays at WOWDLP, I'm getting twisted here, there was too much coffee this morning, and it's rich with the shows like Thought Bowl with Heather and Pete and Roadside Attraction with Brian McGuire. Sunday afternoon from 1 to 3, we have our friend Eric Bond and the Talk of Tacoma for 2 hours of interesting guests and personalities from around town. Listen to next Sunday from 8 to 10 with our friend Gail Behrens, The Night Ride Home. Gail serves an eclectic and selective mix of songs from a host of musical genres. We invite you to visit our website, tacomaradio.org, and look at our programming schedule. There's everything for everyone in this local community radio station. Tacoma Radio relies on your support. And until next time, see art in everything you do, experience the visual, and thanks for listening. We hope you have a great day. Bye-bye.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream. I've been dreaming since I woke up today. It's starring me in my sweet dream, 'cause she's the one makes me feel this way. And even if time is passing me by a lot, I couldn't care less about the dues you say I got. Tomorrow I'll pay the dues for dropping my load, a pie in the face for being a sleepy bulldog. You may pick up your ears, or you may be daydreaming for a thousand years. What a day for a daydream, custom made for a daydreaming boy. I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy.